You're going to love this. Just love it.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, on the Progressive Voices channel, on Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, and 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik. This is your broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Glad you could join us here today. As I said, it has been 2 years now since Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor from Booz Allen Hamilton, came out with his extraordinary disclosures that he gave to journalists Glenn Greenwald and others concerning the way the NSA has really was scooping up, as we've now learned, illegally scooping up every phone call that was made in this country, at least the metadata from it, the records, who you called, when you called them, how long you talked to them. Last week, the U.S. Congress finally put an end to that, sort of, kind of, with the Freedom Act, replacing portions of the Patriot Act, the first time since 9/11 that the Patriot Act has been revised in any way, shape, or form, for the most part. So that's good news, kind of. Edward Snowden wrote about all of this last week in the New York Times, marking the 2 years since his disclosures, talking about how he was remarkably, you know, described as a terrorist when he came out with this information. I remember being outraged about it at the time on the air, playing clips from Joe Biden and Sarah Palin, both regarding Edward Snowden as a terrorist. Well, Edward Snowden writes, 2 years on, the difference is profound. In a single month, the NSA's invasive call tracking program was declared unlawful by the courts and disowned by Congress. After a White House-appointed oversight board investigation found that this program had not stopped a single terrorist attack, even the president, who once defended its propriety and criticized its disclosure, has now ordered it terminated. This is the power of an informed public, wrote Edward Snowden correctly. Once people know what's going on, things can change. It's when we keep things a secret that things don't change and things get only worse. He continues, ending the mass surveillance of private phone calls under the Patriot Act is a historic victory for the rights of every citizen, but it is only the latest product of a change in global awareness. Since 2013, institutions across Europe have ruled similar laws and operations illegal and imposed new restrictions on future activities. The UN declared mass surveillance an unambiguous violation of human rights. In Latin America, the efforts of citizens in Brazil led to the Marco Civil, an Internet Bill of Rights, recognizing the critical role of informed citizens in correcting the excesses of government. The Council of Europe called for new laws to protect whistleblowers. The power of an informed public. One of the things that Edward Snowden talked about when his disclosures first came out was about the privatization of our U.S. security apparatus, the privatization of defense contractors following 9/11. And now Tim Shorrock, an investigative journalist, has a provocative article, I would call it a warning, in The Nation last week, entitled How Private Contractors Have Created a Shadow NSA. We're going to speak with Tim Shorrock about that in just a few minutes. It's a fascinating article, and it is disturbing, because while things are getting better, as Edward Snowden suggests, there's still a lot of work to be done, and there's still a lot of stuff that goes on in secret that shouldn't be going on in secret. And not only is it going on in secret, but it is being privatized to contractors. 3 million, I believe it was, 3 million American citizens have top security, top secret security clearance at this point. 3 million? What kind of secrets are these? Anyway, we'll be speaking with Tim Shorrock about that in a little bit. In the meantime, some politics here first. Some amazing stuff over the past week. This just comes in from Senator John Thune, Republican from South Dakota. You know, there's this Obamacare case that's in front of the Supreme Court in the next week or two, I believe. We're going to hear this decision from the Supreme Court, whether it will knock out subsidies for some 6 million Americans who are enjoying those subsidies under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, many of whom are able to afford health care for the first time in this country. As you know, the Republicans have been on a jihad against Obamacare, despite its popularity, despite the fact that we've got now 12 million, I believe, people who have signed up for Obamacare under the since that law has been passed. So they continue to come up with new reasons why it's terrible, and the reasons become more and more inane and insane. So this is what John Thune tweeted out in regard to the Supreme Court decision that will be coming soon. He wrote, 6 million people losing their health care subsidies, yet POTUS, President of the United States, continues to deny that Obamacare is bad for the American people. I know. Don't look at me that way, Desi.
It just didn't make sense. I thought, wait, I must have not heard you right.
No, that's what he said. So because 6 million people may lose their health care subsidies because Republicans are challenging Obamacare, therefore Obamacare is bad.
Wow, that's some grade A trolling right there.
Right?
So that's some doublespeak.
Because Obamacare, the subsidies are awesome and people may lose them, therefore Obamacare is bad. This is amazing. Sarah Cliff writes at Vox.com. These are not just health care subsidies that Thune writes about. These are Obamacare subsidies specifically. And Thune is literally criticizing Obamacare by saying that its insurance subsidies are a great program, one that Americans should be worried about losing. It makes no sense. The entire Republican Party at this point makes no sense. Now, John Thune is not, as far as we know, yet running for president. He's one of the very few Republicans, apparently, who are not running for president. The ones who are running for president, you have guys like Rick Perry, who makes even less sense in what he's talking about. And I'm not talking about this just by way of bashing Republicans or talking about presidential politics. I'm sort of trying to get at a bigger picture here. Republicans, as far as I can tell, are quickly making themselves irrelevant. I read a poll last week about the fact that a GOP candidate positioning himself or herself as a conservative on both social and economic issues will now appeal to less than half of the broad base of rank-and-file party members. So a social and economic conservative won't even appeal to a majority of Republicans at this point. The party is disappearing, and that's why Hillary Clinton came out about voting rights last week. It's more specifically why Republicans are trying to restrict voting rights everywhere, because that's the only way that they can win elections. It's an inane party. It makes no sense. The debate has now moved over onto what is now the being considered the Democratic side of the aisle. But really, it's the populist side. It's the popular side of the aisle. But just to give you an example of how ridiculous Republicans have come, here was Rick Perry last week announcing his second candidacy for president as a indicted for felony charges, by the way. Rick Perry, former governor of Texas, says something like this, and everyone cheers.
There is nothing wrong in America today that a change of leadership will not make happen.
What? What? What does he say?
There's nothing wrong that we can't make happen?
There's nothing wrong in America today that a change in leadership can't make happen. And they all cheered it. The cheering went on and on. I mean, you know, I know we have George Bushisms. He used to say stuff like that all the time. So I guess this is what happens when you become a Texas governor. It's insane. It makes no sense, yes?
But he's wearing glasses now, so clearly he is smarter. Yeah. It's a cunning disguise. Nobody recognizes him.
Worked for Clark Kent. So we have this party that is kind of insane and kind of has no relevance to the lives of actual Americans. I read a New York Times, CBS News poll last week showing that 85% of Americans favor requiring employers to offer paid sick leave. 80% favor requiring employers to offer paid sick leave to parents of new children. 71%, huge majorities, support raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 per hour. 68% support raising taxes on those making more than $1 million a year. 57% say government should do more to reduce the gap between rich and poor. So the only way the Republicans at this point can win elections is by either becoming completely inane so nobody knows what they're talking about, or keeping people from getting to the polling place at all. And that's why Hillary came out for voting rights. And by the way, that's why she has come out in favor of progressive ideas like prison reform, immigration reform. She supported these reforms we talked about with the NSA. And then I got an email from one of these folks who support the fast food unionization movement, calling for $15 an hour for fast food workers. Got this just this morning. Secretary Hillary Clinton's surprise phone call to 1,300 fast food workers gathered in Detroit this weekend drew widespread attention. Announcing, quote, "I want to be your champion," Clinton told fast food workers from across the country Sunday, quote, "What you're doing to build the Fight for 15 movement," that's what they're calling themselves, the Fight for 15, "what you're doing to build the Fight for 15 movement is so important," she urged them to, quote, "please keep up the fight." Assuring workers of the impact that their movement has had on the country, Clinton continued, "There's a lot we can do together, and you're showing us what the route is. You're on the streets. Your voices are being heard. We need you." She is not backing away from progressive ideals. Now, some of that may have to do, of course, with her opponents in this race, her real opponents in this race, Senator Bernie Sanders, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, former Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee, and their progressive policies. But she is not doing what many thought she would do, which is move to the center. Or I should say move farther to the right. She's already in the center. She's firmly in the center at best. All of these ideas are center ideas. There's nothing, you know, lefty, nothing commie about it. That's why they have to call out Bernie Sanders every time they describe him as a democratic socialist. He's a socialist. Well, socialism is, yeah, kind of a center idea. Writing at the Washington Monthly, Nancy Letourneau writes, "It wasn't that long ago that the big question everyone asked of Democrats was how they were going to compete in southern states. It was assumed that only by nominating candidates from the South, like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, could we hope to win the presidency. Most of that talk ended with the election and re-election of Barack Obama. Since then, it's been my fantasy," she writes, "that someday pundits will start asking Republicans, how are they going to compete in states like Virginia? Or better yet, West Coast states," which, by the way, Reagan actually won. But of course, the media doesn't talk about that. New York Times, Jonathan Martin and Maggie Haberman wrote over the weekend that this is about they want to make this as much about geography as it is about which voters Hillary Clinton is attempting to appeal to. But that totally misses the point. As Brian Butler at New Republic recently noted, quote, "The nature of Hillary Clinton's strategy involves staking out a variety of progressive issue positions that enjoy broad support. But it's not as straightforward as simply identifying the public sentiments and riding it to victory. The key is to embrace those ideas in ways that make standard Republican counterspin completely unresponsive and thus airs out the substantive core of their agenda. Rather than vie for conservative support by inching rightward, Clinton is instead reorienting liberal ideas in ways that make the Republican agenda come into greater focus." Now, by the way, Brian Butler describes them as liberal ideas. These are not liberal ideas, as those numbers I was reading to you from that poll shows. These are popular ideas. They are center ideas. They are wildly supported ideas, not just on the left, but also on the right, also among Republicans, real Republicans, not these crazy whoever these John Thune and Rick Perry have become. Nancy Letourneau at Washington Monthly goes on to write that Clinton's liberal policy positions, that's in quotes, We'll have the Republicans now running against the minimum wage, against efforts to curb climate change, against immigration reform, against voting rights, against campaign finance reform, etc. So please tell me who loses independence in that scenario. It's not Hillary Clinton, as the New York Times would make it out to be. Oh, she's not going to be able to appeal to independents with these wildly leftist ideas she's coming out with. Wrong. That's just wrong. She, frankly, is doing what Bernie Sanders has been doing for decades, and, by the way, doing it much better than Hillary Clinton has been able to do it so far, because when Bernie Sanders says it, you kind of believe him. When Hillary Clinton says it, you go, well, what's up with that? What's her game? Well, if her game is to appeal to the American people, not just voters on the left, but voters straight down the center, so-called independents, then I would argue she's hitting the nail right on the head. And finally, we've got candidates on the Democratic side who are coming out, what did Howard Dean used to say, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. Things that Democrats actually believe in, things that progressives actually believe in, instead of trying to appeal to Republicans. As Barack Obama, by the way, spent a great deal of his presidency, I should say wasted a great deal of his presidency trying to do. Nancy LaTourneau goes on to write, someday perhaps national political pundits will acknowledge that it is the Republicans who have gotten so extreme as to make a core Democratic message appealing to a broad spectrum of the country. I talked last week, and I will continue to talk about the dawn of the progressive age that I believe we are in. I believe that's true, and I believe it's quite possible Hillary Clinton may have begun to figure that out. At least someone on her campaign has. She's saying all the right things. We'll see if she means it, and we'll see how the public responds to it. If they stick to the issues, however, the issues that are very popular in this country, across this country, not just among some liberal left position, as the New York Times likes to describe it. If she sticks to those positions, she will win in a landslide, should she win the nomination. But we'll see if she wins that nomination. Bernie Sanders is putting up a hell of a fight. All right. Encouraged, frankly, as I am about these things and these progressive ideas and this dawn of this progressive age, that's not to say that everything's going well in this country. It's going to take a long time and it's going to be a long fight, even as things may be moving in the right direction. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done, including in our national security apparatus, which is very not progressive as it is structured, and that too needs to be reformed. We're going to talk a little bit about that after a short break here with Tim Schorock of The Nation. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to The Bradcast. Please stay tuned. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to The Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com here with you. We'll be speaking with Tim Schorock momentarily, hence the music. You know, we've talked on this show, I've talked on this show about how I was actually personally, me and my family were targeted by defense contractors who were contracted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Quite literally, we found out about this when Anonymous actually hacked one of these defense contractors. And we found out that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, right-wing lobbyists in this country, apparently didn't like me, didn't like what I was reporting at bradblog.com, and wanted to target me, wanted to infiltrate whatever the hell it is that I do, which is pretty transparent. But they were, you know, talk of hacking into my home computer networks, planting disinformation, all kinds of things. Luckily, that was broken up when Anonymous hacked into them and revealed all of these emails. Now, you might remember at the exact same time, the Bank of America was working out a deal with these same private defense security contractors to go after Glenn Greenwald, who at the time they regarded as a trouble for them. Well, The bigger picture here that, you know, was most disturbing to me, other than targeting me and my family, by the way, extended family, not just me. What was troubling about it was that these were defense contractors who had, you know, huge multi-million dollar, if not billion dollar contracts with the U.S. government, that they were putting together tools to track terrorists in the so-called war on terror. And now they were turning those tools created with taxpayer dollars against actual taxpayers, against journalists, and folks in unions who in the case of the Chamber of Commerce, they felt were a threat against what they did. And the idea that defense contractors, U.S. defense contractors, were taking money given to them by the taxpayers to use against private citizens is exceedingly troubling to me. And for my money, it's never really been investigated enough, perhaps in no small reason because so many folks in Congress are beholden in some fashion to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and because it was the Department of Justice, yes, our Department of Justice, that actually appointed Bank of America to these U.S. defense contractors in the first place when Bank of America was concerned about what Glenn Greenwald was doing and reporting on WikiLeaks and so forth. And this was before Edward Snowden came into the picture. Once Snowden came into the picture, he also talked about how security contractor system has been just, I don't want to say completely, but damn near completely privatized. Well, that was defense security and defense contractors. But what about the NSA themselves? This week, Tim Shorrock, a Washington-based investigative journalist, author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence, published a disturbing article. I'm going to call it a warning over at The Nation, headlined How Private Contractors Have Created a Shadow NSA. That's troubling. Tim has written at The Nation, Salon, Daily Beast, Mother Jones, The Progressive, Foreign Policy in Focus, and Asia Times. And he joins us now on the broadcast to talk about this disturbing article slash warning. Tim Shorrock, welcome, sir, to the broadcast.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you here. Okay, you, for years, folks in government, in the military, the intel community have been moving out of government into the private sector, really as part of that military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us all about on his way out the door. Now, you write, however, that what's going on with this so-called shadow NSA is very different from the D.C. revolving door that we might be familiar with in the past. How so?
Well, it's different because in the past you had high-level, you had generals and all kinds of officials and people in government and in defense moving to the private sector, but they would often go on to boards of companies not directly related to what they were doing while they were in government. You know, they would go on to a think tank or something like that. Mm-hmm. But now what we have are high-ranking, very high-ranking officials from intelligence and from DOD and from all kinds of agencies moving into contractors and other kinds of private entities where they are sort of replicating the same work they did in the government, except they're being paid millions and millions and millions of dollars for it. And so the reason I think this is more disturbing is that, you know, while there was and is a military-industrial complex, and yes, Eisenhower talked about it, we now have, I believe, a secret new class of people who have their feet firmly implanted in both the public sector, in both the government and the intelligence and the defense sector, and the private sector at the same time. And many of them have security clearances, very high-level security clearances, where they can draw on years of experience and the classified information they get and are exposed to, and they've been exposed to for years. And they can use that now for the benefit of the the companies their firms will work with, like the ones you just sort of talked about at the beginning of your show. Mm-hmm. But it puts them in a position where, you know, these kind of contractors working former officials working for the government. There's really no kind of oversight of this. There's no way that, you know, Congress has shown very little interest in looking into how these contractors work, the kind of relationships that a former official like, say, Michael Hayden of the NSA might have had with some of the companies he's now affiliated with while he was working for the NSA or working for the CIA. And I believe it gives them a lot more power than they had in the past.
And I want to get into some of those specifics with Michael Hayden and so forth. But if I understand your concerns accurately, what you're saying is they used to, you'd have you know, generals or so forth, and they would go maybe on a the board of a bank or a think tank, and they would sort of serve a you know, in a position to make that bank, that board at that bank or that think tank look good. But what you're saying, the difference is now they're taking their skills, whether it's a general or some a high-ranking official from the intelligence community, they're taking those skills, bringing them into a corporate outlet, and continuing to do some of the same work and continuing to enjoy the same top secret access to information. Are they using that information for the company itself, for the corporation, or is your, and that's your concern, or is your concern that those people, those corporations are now being contracted by the government? So essentially we're just outsourcing some of these people and their classification levels.
Well, my concern is both, actually. But, you know, let's take an example like, okay, Robert McNamara, you got us in Vietnam under JFK. He was the Secretary of Defense. He left the Defense Department, left the Johnson administration. Where did he go? He went to the head up the World Bank, you know, apparently because he felt guilt about what he'd done in Vietnam and so on. But he went to the World Bank. That was the kind of move that a lot of these senior officials used to make. You know, they'd go to some institution like that that didn't have a direct bearing what they did before.
Okay.
Then take Michael Hayden. He leaves the NSA. He goes, joins this group, the Chertoff group, where he sort of creates a whole sort of, you know, shadow NSA, like I described in that article, where they bring all these people in from NSA who, you know, have the same clearances they did before. And now they're working, they may be working for the government, they're working for private sector, but they are doing essentially the same thing. I mean, he's out there every day, virtually every day on the media, defending and talking about how great the NSA is and how terrible it is that Snowden leaked these documents and, you know, always defending the NSA. He's not quite on the NSA payroll, but he's still doing it.
Well, what's the problem with that? I mean, and these are a bunch of guys who they certainly bulked up the intelligence community after 9/11 and during the Bush administration. A lot of these people have now moved on, as you say, to these companies. What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem is, when you're talking just in terms of, like, you know, their media appearances, they're often not identified as a member of a company. Now, now Hayden usually is because he's so prominent, but there are many others. If you look at, say, for example, you know, NBC and MSNBC, they always have these security analysts, they're national security analysts, and they're almost always, you know, former, you know, you worked for Homeland Security or you worked for, you know, the CIA's counterterrorism center, and that gives them, you know, a certain kind of expertise in the public mind. And in fact, you know, they deserve some expertise because they served in those positions.
Right.
But they don't tell you they now work for, say, Booz Allen Hamilton, which, you know, makes a lot of money off that same agency, or another company that you know, that does the same thing. Palantir, for example, you know, makes money from NSA contracts. And so by not telling the public is misled. So, you know, they think, well, this guy really knows what he's talking about, and he must have some real insight in how the government works. But he also has money invested in this. He's being paid, you know, by a company that's making their money from those agencies. And so, you know, he has vested interest that they're not telling you about. So on one hand, you know, I think the public is badly misled by the media, by all these people in the media.
So,
but I think that they also have, you know, some powers that former officials never had before.
So the result is when we hear in our media, in our, you know, trusted mainstream media, we end up hearing how important the NSA is, how important the spying is, how important, you know, things like the Patriot Act are, because we are hearing from people who have a vested interest in continuing all of these expanding programs,
correct? Right. They may be working for a company that, say, you know, analyzes intelligence that's collected under the Patriot Act, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, someone like that, of course, is going to say, well, yes, this part of the Patriot Act is, you know, really good and it's, you know, really helps fight terrorism and so on and so forth. But there are clearly, you know, they clearly have interest in there, which drives what they're going to say. Someone else, you know, without that interest would, you know, could have a very different interpretation of how important or not important, you know, the Patriot Act is.
And we so rarely hear from that side, from a counter side. There was so much. I remember when the Edward Snowden leaks happened, and you were hearing all of these guys coming on, not just government officials, but also these private contractors coming
right.
out, talking about how Edward Snowden and these leaks had put us at risk, how Glenn Greenwald is a terrorist that needs to be arrested. And there seem to be very few people on the other side of the equation. And I guess it's because these so-called experts, and you're right, they are expert. They do have an expertise in this, but they also have a stake in this.
They have a stake, and that's the problem.
And
they have a very big stake.
And I should note, by the way, you had mentioned Palantir, and I don't want to let these guys get off the hook without pointing out what jerks they are. Palantir, Barrico, and H.B. Gary, those were, by the way, the three defense contractors who were trying to work out with that deal with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to target me and my family, and they've all been rewarded since. Palantir
right.
has gotten huge contracts, and you're right. When there was a question, because there was some hearing, this did come up in some congressional hearings, some Congress members acted as if they were concerned about it, but there was no follow-up. Nothing was ever done. No one was ever held accountable. Why? Isn't that what Congress is supposed to be doing, supposed to be overseeing these agencies and these private corporations who have contracts with the government?
They are. You know, since 9/11, I think there's only been, you know, three, at the most four hearings on intelligence contractors. And they have all been very kind of, you know, surface, you know, just touch the surface. And they didn't, you know, really bring any people on to really testify about what they do. But they've just really ignored this. I mean, when Snowden came out, you know, 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago today, as a former Booz Allen Hamilton employee, there was a flurry of discussion about it. All of a sudden, I got a kind of interviews with, like, Bloomberg, you know, what's going on here with this privatized, you know, intelligence.
Yeah.
And there was some focus on it. But then, you know, and then Dianne Feinstein and, you know, other leading lawmakers who have responsibility over intelligence were saying, well, this is, you know, we got to kind of take a look at this. But they never did. And I think that part of the reason is, you know, just like any other corporate institution, they get money. They get money from these companies.
Yeah.
I mean, the other day I was kind of laughing to myself as I watched the debate on the Senate bill, and I saw my former senator, when I used to live in Maryland, Barbara Mikulski,
yeah.
you know, defending intelligence professionals
yeah.
and all this. So, you know, she's from Maryland. You know, NSA is a huge employer in her state, you know, the
sure.
biggest employer in Maryland. And if you look, I actually tweeted that day, you know, you look at her, who donates money to her, you know, half of her money, lifetime, comes from, you know, six of the largest NSA contractors. So, you know, she's close to the agency, but she's also, you know, she gets, you know, tons of money from these companies. So she's not going to go against those interests and, you know, and say, you know, what NSA is doing is wrong. And you can almost look at the people that have been most critical of this mass surveillance, like Ron Wyden of Oregon. Now, he doesn't have, there's hardly any, you know, military-industrial complex in his state, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's kind of free to make that kind of critique. So I think it really colors the political discussion in Congress. And, you know, what I actually am most concerned about, though, is the fact that we have, you know, what is it? I forget the Washington Post estimate a few years ago. It's like, you know, a million and a half people with security clearances,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And
more than that. I think it was something like 3 million. It was a ridiculous number.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in the millions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a percentage of the U.S. adult population.
Correct.
A significant percentage.
Yeah.
And you have all these people with classified information, because that's what a security clearance is for. And so, and most of them are working for private companies that contract for the government, and often, you know, contract with corporations too to provide certain kinds of intelligence. And so, you know, you have a huge number of people in our country who are spying on us, who are spying on the rest of the world. And, you know, much of our spying now is domestic. You know, ever since 9/11, they just turned, you know, this incredible NSA spying system, surveillance system, mm-hmm. Onto the U.S. And so it's a global spying system. So you have this huge number of people in our country who have access to this kind of information. And I think the danger also is that this, it's not, when we talk about the NSA, people are, you know, fearful of that agency because it does, in fact, have so much power. But, you know, much of that information that they get from, you know, monitoring telephones and email and cell phones and so on, and all that metadata they collect about mm-hmm. who calls who and when, and the networks you belong to, much of that information goes to domestic, you know, law enforcement, to the National Guard, these fusion centers that are all over the country where they, you know, fuse, quote unquote, intelligence and, you know, that they pick up domestically and internationally and then apply it to, you know, looking at their local areas. And so, you know, it's a scary thought that we have this massive privatized intelligence system.
Well, yeah, and I want to ask you about that. We're speaking with Tim Shorrock, investigative journalist, about his article at The Nation, How Private Contractors Have Created a Shadow NSA. Tim, we recently had the passage of the Freedom Act in Congress to replace at least parts of the Patriot Act, and one of the and there's a seems to me to be a pretty huge split, frankly, in the civil liberties community. Some who were in favor of this of the changes made here, others who thought it hasn't gone nearly far enough. But one of the key changes was the mass surveillance that the government had been doing of all of the phone calls, at least of the metadata from those phone calls, who you called, what time, and so forth. The change from the government, the NSA, holding on to those records versus now, supposedly, private companies holding on to those records, telecoms.
Right.
Do you see any difference at this point in those two? And what are the dangers in each of them as you assess it?
Well, there's certain technical parts of that whole bill and how that's going to work that I'm not that familiar with. Mm-hmm. But I do know that, you know, the way that the telecoms have worked historically with the NSA, you know, has been, you know, a top official, a NSA director or, you know, number two person, something like that, would in the past just sort of cut a deal with a CEO of a company, you know, and they'd say, hey, you know, we really need your help. You know, can we get your phone records? Because, you know, we have this national security threat. And, this, you know, even if people recall, before 9/11, in the spring of 2001, Michael Hayden, who was director of NSA then, reached out to all these telecom firms. This came out later.
Yeah.
And asked them to start turning over records. And some of them did ask for, you know, legal opinions. But for them, you know, pretty much they all agreed to provide some kind of records to the NSA. This was long before 9/11, right?
Yeah.
Only
yeah.
one company resisted, and this was a company called Quest that was
yes.
based in Denver. And the CEO of that company later went to jail. He was prosecuted for supposedly, you know, saying false statements and statements, you know, to shareholders under SEC rules.
But there was questions whether he was being targeted because he didn't play ball
because
with
he
the
didn't
government.
Go along. But yeah. he claimed that he thought his company was getting contracts, and so therefore he estimated their earnings to be, you know, so much. And, you know, these were seen. But, you know, it was sort of an unusual, you know, government case. But and the fact is he resisted, and he, you know, he was penalized. He spent time in jail, and he said since that he thought he was targeted because of that. And
yeah.
and this is before 9/11. So after 9/11, you know, that's the pressure really increased, of course, and the companies went along very easily. But, you know, you go back to the 50s, 60s, that's the kind of deal they made. And that's what I'm kind of, you know, concerned about here, that, you know, companies have always been willing to sort of skirt the law if they were convinced that, you know, it was in the national security interest. And often, if you read James Bamford's, you know, books, The mm-hmm. History of the NSA, his three great volumes about the NSA,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes there was just two people at the company that knew what was going on. And they would just sort of like, you know, tell the technicians, okay, you know, so-and-so is going to be here from the government and just sort of do what he says or she says. And that's how it worked. And that's kind of what I'm afraid of here. So, you know, they maybe it's companies that hold them, but maybe there will be sort of a friendly call. You know, can you provide this information on so-and-so or,
I don't know who I should be more concerned about holding onto the records, whether it's the government or these companies. I got about a minute left here. Tim, you write that there's a great need for more reporting and whistleblowing about the pernicious role of contractors in national security, but that few journalists have explored the world of privatized spying. Is that the solution? Is that how we rein it in? Wait for the whistleblowers to come out of the woodwork and the journalists to do some digging? Is that our only hope at this point? Or
I don't think it's our only hope, but I think it's necessary because I think, you know, when often people use the word state surveillance, right? Surveillance state. Yeah. But it's really a surveillance joint venture between the state and the private sector. And I think we can't forget that. And therefore, we need more light shed on this whole system and how it works with the private companies. And I think, you know, we need more reporting on it. It is sexy to, you know, to go and cover NSA and the hearings and all that. But, you know, look, 70% of the budget goes to private sector companies. Mm-hmm. And we need to know about that if we're going to have the full information that we can act politically on. That's all I'm saying there. Yeah. And I think that we need more leaks about these contractors and, you know, more reporting and more people really looking at it as a joint venture, because that's, in fact, what it is.
70% of the budget, you say, goes to private contractors. Amazing. And with almost zero oversight, at least that we know about.
Right.
Amazing. Tim Shorrock, investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence, and the writer of the article at The Nation this week, How Private Contractors Have Created a Shadow NSA. Check that article out at The Nation. Check more of Tim's work out at timshorrock.com. Tim, really delighted to have you here today. Hope you will join us again in the future to talk about this, because you're right. We need more journalism on this very issue. Thanks, Tim.
Will do. I appreciate it very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and we will be back with more Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. My thanks to journalist Tim Shorrock for that fascinating conversation. More journalism. We need more journalism indeed. Instead, what we got is, you know, Fox News, unfortunately. Bruce Bartlett, who used to work for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, put out a fascinating academic study a few weeks back on how Fox News has hurt the country, how in places where Fox News, you know, when they went on air in any location, they suddenly Republicans started winning more elections, and that what has happened is they have created their own self-contained bubble, which he calls self-brainwashing. And he cited, Bruce Bartlett cited this interview with Bill O'Reilly recently at WWD.com. in which they asked him, do you ever get your news from the bigger digital players like Yahoo? Bill said, not really. I'm so busy reading and doing my book projects and so forth, I get a summation of what's around on Fox News, and I get it in a folder. So that's it. He gets, as Bruce Bartlett tweeted, Fox's Bill O'Reilly gets 100% of his news from Fox itself.
Well, that explains a lot.
That's the self-contained bubble. And that is the thing that I believe is doing Republicans in. I've been trying to call them out for years for that because, frankly, it doesn't help. It doesn't help Democrats, doesn't help progressives to not have a legitimate opposition. And there is no legitimate opposition anymore. So they asked Bill O'Reilly, do you believe in global warming? Desi Doyen, pay attention. Desi, of course, is my co-host on the Green News Report, nationally syndicated at fine progressive radio stations around the world. Do you believe in global warming? They asked Bill O'Reilly. He said, my thing is, if it's cleaner, it's better. I'm not qualified to determine if there's a deity controlling it.
Oh, man.
So that's, I guess, a variation on the I'm not a scientist, but who asks if there's a deity control? I'm not qualified to determine if there's a deity controlling it. Some people say the ice in Antarctica is massing. So there's a lot we don't understand.
Massing?
Massing.
Okay.
Yeah, this is, well, you remember the...
I know, I'm just questioning the term that he chose to use.
Old denier ruse,
yes.
That... yeah, sure, we're losing all that ice up in the Arctic, but down in the Antarctic, we're gaining ice. So it's all...
A huge misrepresentation of the science. Yes, you're right.
Well, that's what they're doing, and Bill O'Reilly doesn't know any better because, you know, he gets a summation of what's going around in Fox News, and he gets it in a folder. So this is the kind of thing you're dealing with in general over at Fox News, but over the weekend... Rick Santorum, who is the 10th Republican candidate now running for president of the United, well, running for the nomination on the Republican side, he sat down with Chris Wallace. And unfortunately, you know, we got a turn of people like Chris Wallace now and Megyn Kelly to ask these Republicans anything because they don't show up anywhere else. They don't show
right.
up on non-wingnut media. Fortunately, Megyn Kelly has been doing a pretty good job holding some feet to the fire. She helped the world see how stupid Jeb Bush was when it came to the Iraq War. And here's Chris Wallace now asking Rick Santorum about the Pope's encyclical that is coming out. When is this new encyclical coming out?
It comes out on June 18th.
June 18th. You regard this as to help the layman, to help people like me who are not Catholic understand what an encyclical is. You call it a great big papal paper.
Yes, it's essentially a position paper that does not quite have the force of the full Catholic Church behind it or the infallibility of the Pope behind it, but it is considered second to
Wait,
that.
It does not have the infallibility of the Pope
yes.
behind it?
Yeah, it's just slightly below that.
Okay. And yet, if the Pope comes out and endorses this encyclical, then now it has the power of the Pope.
Well, it does. It always has the power
it's
of the Pope.
It's got the papal power behind it.
Yes.
This papal paper. In any case... Chris Wallace asked Rick Santorum about this because it looks like the Pope is going to come out and call for action on global warming.
Yes, he's going to do this in advance of the international UN climate talks in Paris, which are supposed to end in a treaty that everybody signs on to. This is in support of that.
Saying that this is a moral issue, right?
Yes.
Because only the survival of humanity is at stake.
Caring for God's creation, yes, he says is an important thing to do.
And the Pope, by the way, it turns out, was a chemist. He's a scientist, right?
Yes, he has a master's in chemistry.
All right, and that's sort of where things pick up here with Chris Wallace and the old I'm not a scientist ruse. Chris Wallace on the Sunday, Rick Santorum on Fox News Sunday.
Pope Francis will release an encyclical on the environment on June 18th, and you suggested recently that the Holy Father should stay out of the debate on climate change. Here you are.
The church has gotten it wrong a few times on science, and I think that we probably are better off leaving right. science to the scientists and focusing on what we're really good at, which is theology and morality.
2 points. If he's not a scientist, and in fact he does have a degree in chemistry, neither are you.
I agree.
And that's one point. And the second point is that somewhere between 80 and 90% of the scientists who have studied this say that human activity contributes to climate change. So I guess the question would be, if he shouldn't talk about it, should you?
Well, we have to make public policy with regard to the environmental policy.
I'm going to stop it there for a second. I love that because all this time, these Republicans have been saying, don't ask me about climate change. I'm not a scientist. And yet, aren't they making public policy when it comes to global warming? Aren't they making policy when, you know, in North Carolina, when they say you can't call sea rise, you have to call it. I don't even know what they call it in North Carolina anymore.
And they also make policy when they make policy, say, on what women are allowed to do with their bodies, on reproductive health. They're not doctors, but they make those decisions anyway. So obviously people are starting to catch on that that's a stupid thing to say. So Rick Santorum is taking it to the next logical place is, well, we have to make policy. We have to make choices.
Well, it's true. They do, even though they're not scientists. And I guess that I'm not a scientist thing doesn't work out anymore. Okay, here's more Fox News Sunday.
So I guess the question would be, if he shouldn't talk about it, should you?
Well, We have to make public policy with regard to the environmental policy.
But you're not a scientist. You said leave science to the scientists.
Well, but the point is that politicians, whether we like it or not, people in government have to make decisions with respect to our public policy that affect American workers. Look at
No. The point is, once your whole I'm not a scientist ruse fell apart, because Chris Wallace pointed out that, well, yeah, you're not a scientist, but you still have to make public policy. Once that fell apart, you got nothing, Rick Santorum, and the rest of the Republicans, who I think are giving up this I'm not a scientist ruse, aren't they?
Dad? It does seem like they're going, like they're moving away from that.
Yeah, because they're saying I'm not a scientist, and yet at the same time, they're making environmental policy. Whether it's, you know, down in Florida, you're not allowed to talk about climate change. North Carolina, where they, what was it? You can't, the state can't put out reports that talk about
sea rise. They can't use the word sea level rise. They have to use, you know, some other strange word.
So they are making environmental policies. They're making environmental policies, if only by default, in not making environmental policies. So back to Fox.
The administration is now proposing this ozone regulation that will simply shut down any manufacturing expansion in this country.
Not true.
So, yes, there are things that are going to happen here that scientists are going to determine, you know, whether we need ozone regulations or not.
And you don't think the Pope has a right to talk about this?
Pope can talk about whatever he wants to talk about. I'm just saying, what should the Pope use his moral authority for? And I would make the argument.
Well, he would say he's protecting
for moral
the
issues. Yeah.
I would say that that's an
protecting
important thing to do, but I think there are more pressing problems confronting.
Okay, so protecting the Earth is an important thing to do, according to Rick Santorum, but there are more pressing problems
than protecting the Earth, because, you know, that's creation care. So the Pope is talking about, hey, God created this place. We're supposed to take care of it, not supposed to rip it to shreds. And also, I just want to point out the ozone regulations, totally not true. Those ozone regulations are designed to save lives because it kills 3,000 to 4,000 people a year.
So protecting the Earth, protecting humanity, there are many more important things to do, like, manufacturing jobs.
Money.
That's money. That's much more important than protecting lives, according to these people.
Confronting the Earth than climate change. And I would suggest that, particularly when it comes to me as someone who's trying to go out there and make sure that we have a revitalization of manufacturing and energy production, the things that create jobs and opportunities, that speculative science, which has proven over time not to have checked out all the predictions that were made 15 years ago, none of them have come true. So all of this certainty, this is what bothers me about this debate. The idea that the science is settled. Anytime you hear a scientist say the science is settled, that's political science, not real science, because no scientist in their right mind would say ever that science is settled.
And what scientists are saying the science is settled?
None.
No, none. So they've made up an argument and then they've destroyed it.
Yes, typical straw man argument. No scientist has ever said that the science is settled. They say that there is an emerging global scientific consensus. Totally different thing.
Well, not to Rick Santorum, because he's got no argument, so he's got to make something up. And that's exactly where all the Republicans are. That's exactly where this crazy party. It's not about politics for me, by the way, people. This is not a partisan issue. This is not, you know, this is just about one major party talking about nonsense. It's not like they're coming back with a reasonable position, with something reasonable to do. They're just talking in circles. It's maddening. And in some respect, they're removing themselves from the actual debate because they're not talking about anything that has to do with reality.
Yeah, there's nothing that they can, there's no really nowhere that they can go with this, because it all does come back to the money. And people are catching on to that, finally.
Are they?
I think they are.
We'll find out. My thanks today to Desi Doyen, our producer, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and to my guest, Tim Shorrock from The Nation. We'll be back with you, same Brad time, same Brad channel tomorrow. Until then, you can listen to the archives of our shows anytime if you missed any of it at bradblog.com and at iTunes and at Stitcher and at TuneIn. And you can find me and follow me on the Twitters and the Facebook at The Brad Blog. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.